Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. This week, I'm joined once again by our deputy editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Jordan kindly stood in last week while I was on holiday. And this week, the big new movie is Alien Romulus, the latest entry in the sci-fi horror series, which you probably know by now. This film is set between the franchise high points of Alien and Aliens and is set to take the saga back to its roots. We'll be hearing from that film's director, Fede Alvarez, and me and Jordan will be reviewing that as well as streaming premieres Jackpot and The Union. But before we get into all that, have you been watching anything else this week, Jordan?
As regular listeners will know, I wasn't able to watch Trapped last week, so I hopped down to my local multiplex at the weekend to watch M. Night Shyamalan's latest and actually very much enjoyed it. A film which has its tongue firmly planted in its cheek, I think, is very self-aware in its slight silliness, but M. Night just knows how to deliver on a high concept. So yeah, that was a good time at the multiplex.
Yeah, I've still yet to catch that. At the multiplex this week, I went to see Bluey at the Cinema : Family Trip Collection, which is, again, yeah. You flagged this last week in the Also Out section. Obviously, we mention Bluey literally every week of this podcast. So, you know,
contractually
fans,
obliged to at this point.
And it was basically, it was good. It was, I just needed to sort of see something with the kids, basically, that fit the bill. It was nice to see a packed auditorium for it. And yeah. I mean, it literally, as I kind of discussed this with you the other day, Jordan, it is just several episodes of Bluey back to back and there's no new content there at all, which to me, I was fine with that because I knew that going in. But if you're expecting anything new at all, I mean, the only kind of new thing is you get this extended opening sequence where they're doing the sort of musical statues type dance and more characters get involved, basically. So once they've counted down the first three, some of the, you know, your favorite supporting characters also appear. So that was fun.
Lucky. But, is Lucky's dad in there?
No, wild. They're all kids. They're all kids, the additional characters.
That's a shame.
It was, you know, that made a change. And it was, you know, to be honest, I appreciated them. And it was one of those things where probably a good thing, to be honest. They didn't really, they more focused for me. It was more kind of funny episodes than the moving ones at the very best. But then it ended on the Jean-Luc episode, so obviously ended on a moving high point. But if they'd done too many of the tear-jerking episodes, I'd probably just been like ruined on a Sunday morning. So that was probably for the best. And we'll probably touch on this during our later conversations, but I also revisited Alien and Aliens in preparation for Romulus this week. Obviously, I mean, not much to really say about those besides two absolute classics, but again, yeah, I'm sure we'll be referencing those, I imagine, during the review of Romulus.
But big time.
I think you may have done this too, but I saw something yesterday that had to sign one of the strictest NDAs I've had in a long time. So I daren't even hint at what that was.
I've been signing NDAs left, right and centre. So yeah. Don't even want to hint to those.
Just safest not to mention it. On to this week's new releases now anyway. And first up, it's time for another dose of interstellar terror with this.
There she is.
You want to break in and steal highly regulated equipment?
This could be our only ticket out of here.
Should be in and out in 30 minutes.
Welcome to the Romulus Space Station.
That is Alien Romulus, the latest film in the long-running series that has become a real staple for cinema ever since Ridley Scott's 1979 classic Alien. That was followed in 1986 by another titan of the genre with James Cameron's Aliens. And the series has had kind of mixed results since then, with a further four films, or six if you count the Alien vs. Predator films, as well as video game and comic book spin-offs. And Romulus is set about 20 years after Alien, featuring a new cast led by Kaylee Spaney's Rain and her quote-unquote brother, Andy, who is a synthetic, played by David Johnson. And before we review the film, we're going to hear from director, co-writer and executive producer Fede Alvarez from when Jordan caught up with him a couple of months back now, wasn't it, Jordan?
Yeah, it was. He was in London to present some footage back in June, I think, late June or July. And yeah, he was on very fine form. He's one of the coolest customers I've ever spoken to. He's just always so laid back and chill, which is maybe how he's able to make such a pulse quickening films that he always seems relaxed no matter what the situation.
So here's Fede now.
Run.
Describe this as a filmmaker franchise, as a filmmaker series. Is that what makes the Alien series as a whole so special, the way that filmmakers are able to put their identity?
I mean, there's no another franchise where it's truly that you will know all the directors, and each one of the directors involved had a body of work that you know some of the other movies, right? Like it's definitely certainly not true for some other big franchises, I would say. I mean, some of them sometimes, but a lot of times the franchise is bigger than the filmmaker, way bigger, so it doesn't really matter. It breaks my heart. There's a lot of things that I should not name names, but there was a trailer for one franchise that came out recently, and I was trying to find out who directed it, and there was nowhere in the piece to know who directed it.
It kind of breaks
my heart sometimes. It's like it's almost like the studios are saying, it doesn't really matter who directed it. What matters is that this is the franchise. And Aliens is not that. And you know, this campaign, you know, shockingly for me, but I was happy to see that it did that way, even the way the studio decide to present to the world by saying it's by this filmmaker and this is the movies he made and you might have seen, and then comes this. So I think it still is a filmmaker franchise, and it really makes a difference from the rest of the franchises out there. I think there are directors and there are filmmakers. And it's a difference. You know, directors just direct people too. You can be great at that, and some people are really good at doing that. I prefer the filmmaker part, where you're just making the film. You are making it. You're actually literally making it yourself. And I think in my career, there was a moment where I felt like movies were suddenly, the movies, because they were getting bigger, I was suddenly deprived from the fun of actually making it myself. You know, there was other people doing these things. I was operating less camera. There was better camera operators. This time around, I just went full back to the beginning. I was like, look, I'll operate more myself. I know the operator is better. Yeah, but anyways, I'm good enough, you know, like to do it. And I get more of a joy out of making the movie if I'm really, really involved at every level that I can. So this one's particularly has been like, for me, it's been like going back to the more the beginning of how I did Evil Dead, like where I'm really like my hands all over everything, you know, that has to do with putting the movie together.
The series has evolved into this place, which is quite different from where it started with Ridley's two most recent sort of prequel films. Why did you want to take the series back to its sort of pure sci-fi horror roots?
Movies are a machine of emotions, right? You go to a movie to feel things, right? Feel things. You want to laugh, you go see a comedy, you want to be scared, see a horror movie, whatever it is. That's what the movie's supposed to do. If you go and watch a movie, you don't feel anything, the movie has failed terribly. There's no version of that where it's success, right? So movies are always trying to make you feel something. That's what we do. That's what we look for. So when it comes to something like this, you think about it and you go, okay, my job here today is to make them feel alien, and aliens made me feel when I watched those. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as just go and remake those movies, because probably wouldn't work, you know. You might want to show those movies to a new audience today, and they might appreciate it, and they're classics, and they're like really timeless movies, but maybe they won't be as scary or intense, just because whatever, the way, the rhythm, the pace, the whatever thing that belong to that era that might not travel perfectly to a modern audience. But the emotions hopefully are the same, can be the same, right? So it's almost like a work of translation, you know. How do you say that today? You know, how do you create, you know, what that scene used to do, how do you do that now? You know, like the moment where Dallas is going around with the flamethrower and then the creature comes out and goes like, hello, terrifying the first time around. Now there's something kind of funny about it. I don't know, because you see him too much. You see the hands. I don't know what it is, the jazz hands. There's something about that
just
moment.
Just put a top hat on it.
Whatever it is. I know, like a masterpiece, right? But it's some things that sometimes they're just not effective as they were at the time, logically, right? So you have to kind of translate those things. What would be the version of that now, right? And
yeah.
So that's a lot of the process. So I felt like, you know, because to give them the emotion of those movies, it has to be a horror movie. That movie originally was 100% pure horror. It was a, like Ridley said, it's a B movie done, executed in an A-plus way.
Yeah.
And that's what it should be. And I think, again, it's like also a lot of the exercise is never trying to think too much on the highbrow side of things. You know, that a lot of these movies have, a lot they have suffered sometimes because they just embrace the highbrow part and they ditch the lowbrow part.
Right? Yeah.
And the more they embrace that, the more they lose their identity and they go like, what was this like? When did we started with this? Well, why are we so far into this thing? So my instinct and my desire as a fan, not even as a filmmaker, as a fan, it's like, what is the movie? What is the alien movie I want to see? And I made the movie that I want to see.
You've spoken about the fact that your film will have all these connections and nods to the wider Alien series. And one of the more intriguing ones to me was in the very first image that you released from the film, the sort of clapperboard still with the facehugger, where you can see the emergency phone in the background, which anyone who's played Alien Isolation will know is from that game. I was curious, was that game an influence on the film in any way?
Absolutely, yeah. It was kind of what made me see that Alien could truly be terrifying and done well. Mm-hmm. When I was playing it for the first time, it was, you know, like anybody that played that game, it's just terrifying. But I was playing that and I realized how terrifying Alien can be if you take it back to that tone. But yeah, I played that a few years after it came out, so it was probably around when I was finishing Don't Breathe, or Don't Breathe was coming out. I was waiting for Don't Breathe to come out that I was playing the game, and that's why at the time I was like, if I could do anything, I would love to do Alien and kind of scare the audience again with that creature in those environments. So funny enough that you mentioned the phone, because it's, I realized in the movie is set up in a way like every time something bad is about to happen, you'll see a phone.
That's the same point over
there.
It's like,
like the game, like you, every time in the game you knew it's a phone. It's like, I'm about to go into some bad set piece. It's the same thing here. You'll see like they're planted strategically throughout the movie. When you see the phone, it's like, you know, brace for impact.
Oh, fantastic. Subliminal messaging. Mm-hmm. The film, as you've said many times, the film is set 20 years after the events of Alien, which gives you this opportunity to bring in elements of Alien and Aliens, two absolute classic films. How have you made this, I guess, the perfect synthesis of those two movies?
I think you have to think about it and look at the movies and believe in them as if they are the real world, right? So that's the approach we did with everybody, and mostly with production design. With Naaman Marshall, worked with me on Don't Breathe and came back to work with me on this one. Yeah, so you start thinking about, okay, who are, I'm sure Weyland-Yutani has a group of engineers and architects and designers that designed these ships and these interiors, right? Someone thought about, you know, those hallways and why they look that way and the doors and the standards openings and their standard engines as well, or Corbellan. The ship you saw there has some engines that are very similar to Nostromo. And so, you know, different size of a ship is smaller, but the designs are the same. So like you think about, they use the same technology for their engines and for the landing gears and how many different versions they can build. They just don't try to reinvent them every time. So we didn't try either. We just embraced the idea that how would that designer think and how would it build the spaces and the ships and the station that you see in our movie. So really trying not to reinvent the wheel. We would really want to be as faithful as some of the designs of the original film. They're slightly different though, you know, because it's a different space. They actually way more detail. I mean, as incredible the sets are on Alien, the resources were less in some of them. So I think our sets are quite fantastic. We had the set dresser, which is the one that is behind usually all those details. She was coming from Blade Runner, Dune, and Dune 2 in Budapest, and she was a star. Like, she really... Wow. Created all these sets to a level of detail you wouldn't believe. Like you were in those labs, in those spaces, any piece of paper you will read and there will be stuff related to what they're doing in there with all the Weyland-Yutani security protocols in them, pages that we turn and read that you've never seen in the movie, but the detail is uncanny. It's really, really amazing. It blew my mind every time I was on set. It really felt like a real world that you could live in there.
And going back to the way that different filmmakers approach these films in different ways, Ridley and James Cameron obviously both approached the xenomorph itself in a very different way. Ridley kept it in the shadows, made it unkillable. Mm-hmm. Cameron brought it out of the shadows, made Numbers the real threat. What was sort of your approach to the xenomorph on that sort of spectrum?
I don't want to spoil too much, but it has a bit of both. And I think I said already, the movie kind of stars like Alien, and for the most part is very Alien. And then it started evolving, and you go, and without noticing, you start being more in that vibe of aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And then it evolves some more and goes to a place. It goes more into uncharted waters on the third act, I would say.
How does living in this world for 3+ years of your life, how does that affect you?
It's been a fantastic experience. It really was. Mostly because the actors, all of them, were fantastic and everybody loved to be in the movie. And they really became a group of friends among themselves, and they still are. And they're constantly talking and they're following every moment of the movie. And they're so excited about it. And they really became really close. So there's something about that that really made the whole experience fantastic. It has been also like, I don't know, my house suddenly got filled with Weyland-Yutani stuff, like, and just like alien stuff and NECA toys everywhere. It's just like my life got inundated by alien stuff. I already had some stuff before, and now I have even more. And now I have the stuff from my own movie. So it's like, that's what, you know, I'm going to have to declutter at some point. It's just insane the amount of, you know, just alien stuff that I have now in my office. It's ridiculous.
So that was Fede Alvarez. Jordan, as our resident alien expert, do you want to give any more context for this new film before we dive into the review?
As you said in that introduction, Romulus is set roughly 2 decades after the events of Alien. It focuses on a new group of characters, a younger group of characters, sort of led by Kaylee Spaney's Rain. And she has a synthetic, or should I say artificial person, for a brother. That is Andy, played by David Johnson. Also in the group is Archie Renaud, who plays Tyler, and Isabella Merced, who plays Kay, who is Tyler's sister. And then you also have another brother-sister pairing, which is Eileen Wu, who plays Navarro, who's kind of the science-y person who pilots their ship, the Corbelon. And Spike Fern, who plays Bjorn. So you have these three brother-sister pairings, and they live on a Weyland-Yutani shake-and-bake colony called Jackson's Star, which is literally on the dark side of the planet. They're mining for a living. There's all these novel diseases that are breaking out. There's basically no hope for these young people on this colony. And what they discover is that there is a Weyland-Yutani vessel has been pulled into the orbit of the planet that they're on, Jackson's Star. And it is their bright idea to go to this abandoned vessel and find some technology which will allow them to escape their circumstances, essentially. This vessel is the Renaissance, a space station made up of twin towers called the Romulus and Remus. But of course, as they board the Renaissance, everything is not as it seems, and there are many deadly and familiar creatures on board. So that's sort of the bare bones of the plot. And there are like a few interesting early setup elements, which we won't spoil because I think they're best sort of discovered in the moment. The main thing to note about the film is the fact that because it is set between the events of Alien and Aliens, it is very much a sort of mashup of those two films, self-consciously so. More so Alien, I would say, initially, in the sense that the early sequences of the film are spent stalking the corridors of a very Nostromo-esque ship. It's all that retro-futuristic production design. All the technology will be very familiar to anyone who is familiar with Alien in particular. But then as the film progresses, it does shift more into Aliens territory, in the sense that it becomes more action-packed. As the trailers have hinted at, there are pulse rifles in this film, so there is those familiar sound effects. Those two elements sort of blend together, I would say, in a fairly effective way, given that, you know, Alien and Aliens are just these famously divergent classics, in that one trades very much on slow burn terror and the other just goes for those sort of pulse quickening thrills and the excitement of facing a horde of aliens. Yeah, there's just so much to talk about with this film. As I've discussed on the podcast before, Aliens, the second one, is my favorite film of all time. So I have a lot of thoughts on this. But before I sort of get too deep, what were your sort of top line thoughts, Matt?
So this was one, I was very excited about this one. Obviously, Romulus has just been on the cover of the mag, and I've just been hugely excited about the film. And around the time you did that interview with Fede, we both saw this footage that he kind of came and presented in London, about 20 minutes of footage. So I sort of saw that, was very hyped by that. So I was very excited about it. Yeah, overall, I actually, broadly speaking, I liked this film, and I would say I enjoyed it a lot. Again, if we're talking in review terms, it was one of those strange films that ultimately for me, I would ultimately probably go with a 3-star review, which is what Kevin Harley, who did the official sort of Total Film written review for us, went for. But for me, it falls into that category of like a 3-star film that I really enjoyed and really enjoyed being immersed in the world. You kind of mentioned there that the production design is kind of just off the charts in this, the world building, just that battered industrial chic that you sort of expect from these films. Right from the beginning, I just loved being thrown into that world and being immersed in it. And there were things I liked, like I liked the back to basics approach. I liked that with this kind of mission that this young gang go on, there is a bit of a ticking clock element to it. I liked the straightforwardness of it in that way. And again, maybe remind me of some of Fede's other horror films where it's kind of tight and lean and, you know, it goes for it in terms of the fairly restricted setting and limited amount of time. So that worked well for me. Also, yeah, I should mention, I really liked Kaylee Spaney and David Johnson, who are effectively the leads. Well, there's a couple of the other people play key roles too. I actually really liked both of their performances. Like, they don't necessarily, like with Kaylee's character, Rain, doesn't necessarily have like the hugest amount of character development, but I liked their relationship. And I thought I really liked her as the kind of, you know, resourceful, determined, you know, someone you can tell is going to be an asset, you know, in that kind of situation. And then I think the sort of synthetic android roles often give people a chance to show off with their acting in a way, which I think David Johnson took that and did do a really good showcase. And he gets to do a couple of different things with the nature of this character as well, which I thought were impressive. So I really like those two. But yeah, just I didn't find it as scary as I sort of hoped I might be, especially based on that original footage that we saw. That was among the scariest stuff, really. And I thought there'd be maybe a bit more of that. Yeah, so I didn't find it quite as scary as I hoped. And then I had a couple of qualms with a couple of things that I won't go into too much detail with because of potential spoilers and things. But yeah, there's a couple of things that I wasn't completely sure about. One thing in particular, which again, I won't mention or hint at, but there was, you know, at least one what I would describe as a misstep, and another thing I was a bit less sure about. Yeah, what did you think after, you know, obviously having done all the interviews, the cover feature? Like, because I don't have the any of the sort of video game or expanded world sort of investment in Aliens. I've just seen the films, basically.
I certainly don't know as much as Fede. He went deep into sort of comic and novel tie-in lore, which, went over my head. But I would say I definitely like this film a little better than you. If I was reviewing, I would probably give it 4, but it was never sort of troubling a 5. It was sort of in that sort of area. The things that I liked about it were pretty much what you covered there, in the sense that the sort of craft and just the filmmaking behind it is just genuinely impressive. And it's so nice to return to this sort of tone and this world for Alien after, you know, Ridley Scott's prequels, which took the series in a bit of a different, grimier sort of direction. Like, I just love being back aboard like a Weyland-Yutani spaceship, basically. Like, just that production design, just it just makes something in my heart sing, you know. Like, I just love that element of it so much. And I think Fede does, like, he's very good at crafting, like, quite intense set pieces. Like, there's a sequence in here which very much harkens back to his work on Don't Breathe, in the sense that it's very quiet and people have to move silently through a space, otherwise something very bad is going to happen. So you can see exactly where that sort of skill set has come into play. There are a couple of, like, just in extremely creative and inventive moments as well, sequences, set pieces, which you do sort of get a glimpse of in the trailer, but we won't speak too much about, just because, again, I think it's just nice to discover those moments of the film. But I would say, even though this film is getting a bit of stick for being a bit of a nostalgia trip, a bit of a sort of franchise retread or a remix in a way, I think he does bring some new interesting things to it. And he does take some very big swings with the series as well. The much hint of that sort of wild third act is, like, yeah, genuinely, like, quite freaky and different, and does also harken back to one of the more reviled moments in the entire series as well, but redeems it in a way, which I thought was quite an impressive thing to do. Like, it just delivers on the promise of something that happened in a previous Alien film that everyone hated, basically, but he does it well. Not perfectly, but well. And I like the fact that he really relied on practical effects. Like, you can really tell that pretty much every face hugger in this film is just like a prosthetic face hugger, like an animatronic face hugger that's scuttling around. Like, there are very few just obvious CG creatures that have been inserted, and that extends to the xenomorph as well, where it's clearly just an animatronic or a man in a suit in a lot of cases. The one big letdown for me, though, was the fact that it didn't entirely do justice to the xenomorph in bringing it back. I think Fede spoke a lot about, certainly to me, about bringing back the original xenomorph, about going back to Giger's biomechanical designs about not making it do all the kind of jumpy stuff that we saw in Covenant. But then what you do get here is just a tiny bit familiar, and there isn't enough new done with the xenomorph, and what is there just isn't as exciting as you sort of hope it's going to be with that creature in particular. And there's also just the odd fact that because there are only six core cast members, there just aren't enough people to kill, basically, because you just have to have a few people sort of make it to the end to be able to bounce off each other. The kills are just very few and far between, which is a tiny bit odd. I guess you did have the same situation with Alien, which is obviously also a very small cast of characters, but those deaths just hit a lot harder in Alien than they do in here, which I found a little unusual, just because Fede is a bit of a gore hound. Like, you watch Evil Dead and it's one of the gnarliest films you've ever seen. Like, it's just so uber violent. And yeah, I was surprised by just how almost restrained this was in terms of the violence.
And I was surprised as well, because again, going back to the sort of 20 minutes of footage that we saw like a couple of months back, again, that has some of the gnarliest stuff in it, really. And so I suppose that set me up to think, oh, it's going to get ever more gnarly from there on.
Yeah.
To a sort of almost unbearable level. But that, again, was perhaps the max gnarliness, and didn't quite reach it. I mean, there's a few moments, like, I mean, he does some good things with the acid blood. In a way, that was always something, you know, when I was younger and saw the films, that just always felt like a really scary part of these creatures. And they make good use of that. But I agree with you there that's what I was surprised by, that for me, the best set pieces didn't involve the xenomorphs, which was a surprise. Like, and again, obviously, there's, you know, the distinction with Alien and Aliens, how obviously Alien was so much more of a slow burn kind of horror film. And Aliens, obviously, just the all-out action take on that. This, in a way, it's kind of reasonably slow burn as far as like modern films go, I would say, in a way that I liked. But then I thought, again, especially because of this, you know, trying to land between the style of Alien and Aliens, I thought it might go more all-out in the action as things went on. So, I thought we just might get a bit more xenomorph action, really, to be honest. And again, there was a couple of slightly cringy callback moments as well, which I just didn't think it needed, and they kind of clunked a bit for me.
Yeah, I think this is where a lot of the criticism is coming from about it being a bit of a franchise remix, in the sense that, yeah, there are, let's say, very famous lines from the previous films that are just quoted verbatim in this one, which It's just pure fan service. Like, there's just no other explanation for why it's in there. Certainly doesn't make sense that characters in this film would be saying this ahead of, you know, characters that say it in the timeline of the actual movies. Like, yeah, pure fan service, which, yeah, really didn't need to be there. And just more broadly, it does riff on other things in Alien films, like quite a lot of things. If you know these films well, you'll be sort of nodding along throughout the whole thing, going, oh yes, that's from that. That's kind of familiar from that. Things like music cues, little bits of set decoration. It sort of extends beyond Easter eggs to sort of ideas and sort of set piece sequences and things like that, which will all just be sort of familiar, but done in a slightly different way, which, you know, might not be entirely what you're looking for, or might be exactly what you're looking for after Prometheus and Covenant did something so different with these films. Maybe that's exactly what audiences want, is something that's just a little bit more familiar, like a little bit more on home territory with these films. And Fede is just clearly just like such a huge fan of these that he knows how to do it well enough that it doesn't feel sort of cynical.
And to be fair, it is such a tricky balance to strike, I think, because you genuinely are damned if you do, damned if you don't with this kind of thing. Because if you just do too much of a sort of greatest hits vibe, then, like, you know, you're kind of criticized for just, you know, wallowing in nostalgia and whatever. But then if you do something too different, then you're just not delivering what people want from an Alien film. And I mainly came away from it thinking, like, I felt satisfied that, like, as someone who likes these films, I felt satisfied, and I enjoyed spending more time in that world, you know, in a way that was well done and, you know, delivered just a bit of extra, you know, enjoyment in that world, basically. So I enjoyed that. But at the same time, it didn't quite take it to the next level for me. It didn't quite make me feel, oh, there's absolutely loads of life left in this franchise. Like, you know, it didn't sort of reinvent it or feel like, you know, I mean, and in a way, again, to be honest, I kind of like the fact that it is a fairly sort of contained story. Like, it's often there's danger with these things that they just feel like they're trying to set up like a new trilogy or something. Whereas this is a classic case of, I mean, as they're doing here, they've obviously just expanded the world that was already there. So there's always opportunities to do that. But I liked that it just told its little story and didn't really feel like it was just, like pitching for sort of further films or telling you half a story and being like, oh, this is where we're going to go in a new sort of series or whatever. So I liked that side of it. I mean, again, I just enjoy seeing how they've done it. Enjoy that reliance on practical effects. That there are just so many just cool little details I liked. Like, they've got these kind of video call watches that have got these really kind of, they're really chunky and they've got these kind of glitchy graphics. And even just like the target assistance on the pulse rifles, for example, there's just cool little details like that that just have that sort of retro future feel to them that I really like.
It's all very analog, sort of in line with the technology in Alien, essentially, where everything's in sort of dot matrix displays and there's sort of almost VHS tracking lines across all the screens, and it's all like CRTs rather than like nice flat screens or whatever. Like, it's all that stuff, like I said, it's just, it just really makes me happy to see all that stuff on screen, just because it's just so evocative of that first film especially, but it very much carried over into Aliens as well. I went into this film really, really wanting to like absolutely love it, and I came away not loving it, but still really liking it. I will say I was like fairly freaked out by some things in it that we won't go into too many spoilers on, but there is like something in it which I did actually find very unsettling and scary, which I honestly can't remember like the last time I was like genuinely freaked out and scared in the cinema. So like, fair play for doing that. The one thing I was a little bit surprised about, because you know, the Alien films just generally, as Fede spoke about in his conversation with me earlier, is like they've always just felt like they've just had very distinctive like filmmaker film prints all over them. Alien is such a Ridley Scott film. Aliens is such a James Cameron film. Alien 3, despite him disowning that film, does have just like nihilism in it. And Resurrection just is like a weird Jean-Pierre Jeunet film, like smashed together with sci-fi horror. Whereas this, I did think that his like perspective felt a tiny bit lost, in the sense that he was just paying so much homage and respect to especially what Ridley Scott and James Cameron had done, that his voice almost didn't come across enough in a way. Like, I would love to have seen a version of this where he didn't feel like he had to, you know, worship at the temple of Cameron and Scott so much, like that he could have taken it a tiny bit more in his own direction. But you do get the bits in there where it is him safety off doing something completely unexpected for the series. So you do have those flashes, and those sort of are the best moments. So yeah, I wish he had a tiny bit more confidence to do his own thing. But you know, I'm not going to begrudge a filmmaker bringing two of my favorite films, and one of which is my favorite film, sort of back to the big screen in a way, in a very respectful and reverential way, like, and one that is just very accomplished and well done for the most part. So no huge complaints here, but minor niggles.
Yeah, I feel very similar, really, and maybe even I sort of came across more negative than I intended to, because like I say, I actually just genuinely enjoyed watching it. And another thing I'll just highlight as well quickly is that we spoke obviously a lot about the practical effects and some of the sort of gnarliness and it being quite claustrophobic and intense, but there's just some really great like visual effects in it as well, some great sort of big visual effects, and some of the kind of spacey stuff. It just looks really stunning, great in that way. Yeah, and considering, especially as you know, I think of it in my head, as this kind of gnarly like little film, but it does look great in those moments as well. And it's the sort of film I would very happily will watch this again. And again, just partly just to just immerse yourself in the world and soak up those little details and things. And it's the kind of thing I want to read a lot more about as well, even though I've already read quite a lot on it in the run-up. Like, it's a film you really want to kind of delve into.
I would love to speak to Fede again about some of the things he does in this film, because you come out just going, you just need to speak to people about what you've just seen, because it's so kind of crazy, some of it. So yeah, hopefully one day you'll chat to us again.
If you fancy the sound of that, that is Alien Romulus, which is in cinemas now. And next up is an action comedy set in the near future, where if you win the lottery, your number could be up.
Katie Kim is our new jackpot winner. Happy hunting, L.A. I definitely didn't get the part, so there's no need for the death stare.
She's my jackpot.
What is happening?
Uber for Katie? Did that look as cool as it felt?
What is going on?
Katie, you won the lottery. And now anyone with a losing ticket that kills you before sundown gets her money. Legally.
Okay, that's murder.
Oh, not in California. It's just a chance at the big time.
Right, so this is Jackpot, which is the latest film from Paul Feig, and it stars Awkwafina as Katie. I mean, the premise here is a high concept, to say the least, where we're set in near future California, so it's 2030, and a brief kind of montage at the beginning fills us in on the fact that there's been this new lottery introduced with these huge jackpots, but the difference here is basically when someone wins it, there until sundown, other people can basically come and kill them to claim the winnings, and they've got until sundown to survive, and if someone kills them, they can claim the prize, basically. And they have some huge jackpots. So, of course, it's become this massive thing. It's like, you know, vaguely Hunger Games-y, you could sort of describe it as. But Awkwafina's Katie is someone who's recently moved to California to try to revive her acting career. So somehow she's completely unaware of this lottery that's been introduced in California. And as, you know, as unsurprisingly, she ends up accidentally getting hold of a winning ticket. And, you know, people obviously instantly turn on her to try and claim the winnings for themselves, which leads to her running into Noel, who's played by John Cena, who is basically offers his services to protect lottery winners, to keep them alive until sunset for a cut of a percentage of their winnings. The story goes from there, really. So it's this duo on the run trying to survive, you know, with basically everyone after them. And also in the mix, there's this kind of shadier high-tech lottery protection service headed up by Simu Liu. And so they kind of run into them as well. So it's basically a case of, can Katie and Noel survive until sundown, you know, amid these circumstances? So as I mentioned, it's a bit of a crazy high concept. To sort of dive straight into it, for me, this just didn't really work, if I'm completely honest. I like John Cena and Awkwafina a lot. So that helped, that I find them very likable. So if I was going to spend time with any of these people, you know, we'll smile along to some of the things they said. But I had that slight problem from the get-go that the concept just really didn't feel thoroughly thought out to me, but a bit first draft. And obviously the whole point is that they're putting a spin on something that could be a very dystopian thriller take, but instead this is just like a broad comedy in the style you expect from Paul Feig in many ways. Yeah, it just so just from the get-go, I just did not buy this as a concept. And especially the fact that, I mean, it's only 2030, so we're only looking like 6 years in the future. And it's a very recognizable California, you know, it's not like it's not the dystopia of like, you know, Welcome to New York or anything like that. To me, just from the get-go, it was utterly unbelievable that Katie could have gone this long, 6 years, without realizing that this was happening in California. I mean, the internet does exist. Global news does exist. So I basically had these problems with the premise that I could have forgiven if the film was just very funny and if it was just really good, silly fun. And I laughed a lot. And it, you know, was the vehicle for a lot of jokes and great action scenes. But none of the jokes really landed for me at all. And some of the action scenes were like, I mean, they were sort of competently put together, but there were no like set pieces that really made me like think, whoa, you know, great set piece there, you know, like hairs on the back of my neck standing up with that one. And again, just in with the whole tonal weirdness that it was just, and the sort of first draft feeling I had with it, is the action was, it was sort of violent in places and sort of a bit gritty and unpleasant, and people really kind of punching each other and trying to kill each other, you know, in various ways with various weapons. But then John Cena's a big guy, obviously, but he could throw people with like superhuman strength and like, you know, he's like throwing people through walls and stuff like that in a way that just has no bearing on, you know, real world physics. And then there's this sense that, like, again, obviously the whole premise is that Katie is unprepared for this because she, you know, she doesn't know what's going on. The plot excuse given is that she's looked after her ailing mother for many years, So she's been a bit out of the loop for that reason. But they also kind of hint early on that she's done some stage fight training. And so, again, that feels like a vague excuse that she can sort of handle herself. But again, she was just too well equipped to handle herself, you know, in this situation, I felt. And just didn't work for me at all, this film. But Jordan, did you enjoy it more than I did? I've just gone off on one there a bit.
You covered all the salient points there, I think. I would say that I enjoyed it slightly more than you. Some of the humour did connect with me, particularly. I just find John Cena like just a very funny screen presence. Like pretty much anything he does like makes me chuckle. So just on that level alone, like I enjoyed this purely for John Cena. He does just play the John Cena character, basically, like the physical tank who's actually a bit of a goofball, like has a bit of a soft center. Like that's just the John Cena thing, and he just reprises that here. And it's sort of just as effective here as it is in every other film that he's in. as you say, the actual premise itself just makes absolutely zero sense. It's just like a comedy spin on The Purge, basically, but The Purge for one person. it's just very daft, which if you just look at it as a comedy, fair enough. But if you interrogate it in any way, it just absolutely makes zero sense. The biggest issue I had was just the contrast between the violence and the comedy of it all. Because you do see people like die on screen in like fairly violent ways at points. And that just feels very weird when people are just consistently wisecracking throughout the whole film. Like people just don't really seem to be affected by quite violent deaths happening around them, which is very odd. And I thought Simu Liu was like really hamming it up as the villain in this film. It's a bit of a strange Shang-Chi reunion, of course, because Awkwafina and Simu Liu were both in that film. Awkwafina also plays a character called Katie in Shang-Chi, if you remember. So this is the second film that they starred in together where she plays a character called Katie, which is a little strange. But he's purely there to just be a happy villain. There's never any question about where that character is going and how that's going to happen. And then there are just like big logic gaps in terms of how things work. There are strange cameos here as well, like Machine Gun Kelly pops up for a sequence, which I found very odd.
I was about to complain about that. Beat me to it. Whereas, I mean, again, obviously we're based in the UK. I'm guessing he's more of a thing in the US. But why does he just pop up in things? And there's just, again, like in the way you get sometimes, you know, I always think of like Zombieland, I suppose, is just the best case of a cameo like that in this dystopian world where a sort of a real celebrity, so to speak, pops up unexpectedly. But he just didn't add anything to it at all, you know, to me.
No, not at all. I mean, he's purely there just for the name turns, because he is playing a version of himself, like basically a stoner who has a panic room that they want to use. That's the extent of his characterization in this film. So yeah, that was very odd. Mm. And then you also have Sean William Scott showing up. I thought his like little bit was fairly effective. I quite enjoyed that. Sort of sets up the stakes in an interesting way. And then you also have Dolly De Leon, who... such a strange pivot after previously brought to attention in Triangle of Sadness, spoken about as like a potential Oscar nominee for that film. And then her role in this is just so minimal and bizarre. And I don't know why on earth she's in this film, but she is. So yeah, there's just a lot of peculiar elements that have gone into this, which I would very much question. But I can't say that I did not enjoy it. Like, it sort of kept my attention. I chuckled fairly consistently throughout. For some reason, I just gave it a bit of a pass. Like, I just thought it doesn't really have any pretensions about being the next great action comedy. It just is purely trying to entertain you for a couple of hours, and it just sort of does that.
Can I say something positive as well? I liked, again, just because I'm also a fan, I liked just the randomness that John Cena's character was just a big Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fan. Especially as this isn't like, you know, produced by this, you know, Paramount look after the Turtles. So there's no kind of tie, but when we first meet him, he's kind of sort of singing along to a Turtles related song when we first meet him, in a slightly sinister way almost. But I liked just the randomness of that. And again, if I do have to say a positive that kind of came from it, like I say, I like these two actors. And I liked the fact that John Cena's Noel was just nice, basically. That was kind of his his main character. And that was the main, you know, kind of twist with his character, that he's just nice. He just wants to help out because he's sort of a nice guy. And they developed this nice sort of friendship. I quite enjoyed that. And I quite like the fact that it was basically just a friendship and there's no hint of romance or anything like that. So I thought that was pleasant about it. But yeah, I really struggled with the film. And there's also, I wanted to add as well, just among the just various plot holes and ill thought out premise is people aren't allowed to use guns either. Or they're not allowed to use bullets particularly, but they use some things that are very similar to guns.
Yeah. Rubber and bullets. And, yeah.
That was just one of those like, oh yeah, I guess we got to say that because otherwise it just doesn't make even less sense. And it just felt, do you know what I mean? It just felt so thrown together that, yeah, I just couldn't get on with it. And even I found myself just thinking like, obviously Katie's come from outside of California, somehow completely ignorant of this going on in the world. But just the fact that it's restricted to one state made me think, but is the rest of the United States not outraged that this is going on in California? You know, obviously everyone turns feral as soon as there's a winner, you know, they could potentially steal from. But are there just no wider repercussions to the outside world? Do they not have family members that live in other states who would be horrified that they had killed a fellow citizen for money? Sorry, but it was just that it fell at the premise for me and just wasn't funny enough to recover. And it also did that thing where it has a few supporting characters in it that are just so annoying that they go beyond being like, you know, the funny. Like, for example, a time when it was done very well, I would say, is in a Paul Feig movie, is Rebel Wilson in Bridesmaids. She obviously is there to irritate Kristen Wiig's character, but I actually just found her very funny in that film. Whereas here, you've got this kind of roommate character that Katie moves in with when she comes to California, and she's just so cartoonishly irritating. I found it unbearable basically when she was on screen, really. And again, just not funny, just purely annoying. But yeah, I don't know what your reaction to that character was.
Yeah, I agree completely. Just slightly too larger than life, despite everything that's going on around. At least you could sort of buy Katie as a sort of actual human, but definitely not the roommate character, like a pure comedy device, basically, which wasn't really funny enough. Yeah, so such a strange film for Paul Feig to have made. I don't know, he seems like a director in a bit of a crisis at the moment. Like, I just don't think he knows what his voice is, really. He's on like a really bad run with this, and especially The School for Good and Evil, which came out a couple of years ago. Also a streaming movie, that one for Netflix, which was just appalling, like just so bad.
Last Christmas was very bad as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like
Simple Favor. I actually did like Simple Favor quite a lot, actually. So
yeah, and that did he's do got, all right. So yeah,
and he's got a sequel for that. He's got a sequel for that next, I think. So maybe he'll get his mojo back with that. But it didn't really feel like a film that screamed out for a sequel to me, anyway.
He really needs to get out of this like streaming jail that he's found himself in, and I don't know, make a sequel to Spy. Come on, everyone loves Spy. That's crying out for a sequel.
Yeah. But if you fancy giving Jackpot a chance, that is streaming on Prime Video now. Next up, it's another streaming movie featuring a mismatched duo on an action mission.
Two nights ago, a list containing the identities of every U.S. spy was stolen. And to get it back, we need someone who is not on that list.
We need a nobody. A nobody I can trust.
So what, you guys like the FBI or something?
We work for the Union.
So this is The Union. Jordan, do you want to set this one up briefly for us?
Yeah, so this is directed by Julian Farrino and is a straight-to-Netflix movie. It stars Mark Wahlberg as Mike. He is a blue-collar construction worker. We're actually introduced to him in bed with one of his school teachers while he is a grown man. So this is the kind of person that we're dealing with here. One day, Halle Berry's Roxanne walks into his bar and unceremoniously drugs him and drags him to London, where she reveals that she is in fact a spy and a member of the Union, which is they call themselves a sort of blue collar CIA or FBI, essentially. They're the people who get the work done behind the scenes. They're not the people who are walking around with FBI in big yellow letters on their jackets. They're the people on the street that you don't even notice who are actually secretly making the world tick along as it's supposed to. You also have people like Jackie Earle Haley and Mike Coulter amongst their ranks. Their mission essentially is to retrieve, in time old spy movie fashion, a list of real names of spies all around the world. I'm sure that's been a MacGuffin in about a dozen spy movies at this point. But anyway, we've got again here. And for some reason, they need to bring in Mike to do it because he has no background. He is just the everyman. No one could ever know that he was connected to the union because he has no ties at all. So he's trained in sort of 2 weeks, whereas it usually takes 6 months. And he's put on this mission, which pretty much all takes place in London, to retrieve this list from a mysterious, shadowy organization. And you also have people like Russians coming in who are involved as well. It's again in a similar vein to Jackpot, a sort of action comedy, which throws in the spy element. The film was sort of summed up in one line for me, where Mark Wahlberg kind of struts in and claims that he's the Jersey James Bond, which horrified me and appalled me in equal measure, because I absolutely detested this film. I thought it was just completely inept on every level, just so derivative and dumb and just uninteresting. And everyone just seemed to be there purely for the paycheck. I didn't get the sense that anyone was like artistically behind this film in any way. All of the London stuff was just a bit embarrassing to me. Maybe it's just because I live in London that all this stuff seems quite normal to me. But the HQ is in the BT Tower and they make such a big deal of it being in the BT Tower. It's just a big foam mast. Like, what are you doing? And all the action was just a bit familiar. Nothing at all that exciting or interesting happens. There are like occasional efforts to do something a little bit different. There is, I won't spoil which production it is, but there is a moment in the middle of a set piece where they wander into the middle of a West End show, which gave me a little bit of a chuckle, raised my hackles. Apart from that, just everything else about it just felt like just so lame, just so, you know, when you're just watching streaming movies and you just know that you're watching a streaming movie, it's like this film could just never have been released in cinemas. Otherwise it would have just been laughed out of the cinemas. Like, this just felt like it could only exist on streaming. It just purely exists, I think, just to fill in a spreadsheet box where they were like, we just need a bit of content on this day. What can we afford to put here? And it just made me quite sad, especially about Halle Berry, who is like a genuine talent, like Oscar winner. Does she really need to do films like this now? Like, that was all just a bit sad to me, and nothing about it I thought was worthwhile on any level. Like, I'm sorry that sad probably sounds a little bit harsh to the people who made it, but I didn't see a reason for this to exist.
This is one of those things where, like, I can't massively argue with a lot of what you've said, but at the same time, we've, strangely this week, we've ended up in sort of reverse positions on this Jackpot, whereas I'm in a position on this where I can't by any means argue that this is like a great film, like massively worthwhile in your time and whatnot. But for me, it's sort of just about ticked that box of, if you needed something to pass the time and watch at home for a couple of hours, I thought it was, you know, solidly entertaining enough just about, you know, to get you through. I say that without really being able to massively refute any of your points. One of the things for me that was, I mean, ultimately this is a negative really, but it literally just feels like every element you've seen in, I mean, I'd say one other film, but several other films probably, it feels entirely constructed of bits you already know from another film, including the training montage, you know, the being introduced to gadgets and being trained up quickly, the mission gone wrong that sets things up right at the beginning. I mean, many of these things are Mission Impossible riffs, it felt like. Yeah, just everything about it, like you say, the sort of MacGuffin, the, you know, agents' identities being leaked again. It's definitely, I feel like that's been in a couple of Mission Impossibles, but it's just such a common MacGuffin.
It is just the knock list, isn't it? Is that from the first Mission Impossible? Just, oh, come on. You can't just like wholesale lift the exact plot from Mission Impossible. Like, oh God.
Yeah. So every single element you have seen done before. But I thought it did it, again, okay enough just to entertain for a couple of hours. You'll completely forget about it immediately after seeing it. It will be one of those films that will just be completely forgotten immediately after this weekend when it's open. It'll be forgotten. As there always is, of course, there's a vague hint of sort of franchise setup kind of crowbarred in at the end. But, I mean, I'd be shocked if we ever see any more from these characters.
Yeah.
But that said, I wasn't angry for those couple of hours. I sort of, you know, followed along, in, you know, well enough. It's that weird thing where, in fairness to Jackpot, it's trying to do something a bit different. Whereas this one doesn't try and do anything different. But whereas this one, it doesn't try, but it just does the bare minimum. Whereas Jackpot arguably tries, but fails worse for me. Whereas this at least worked on its own terms, just about. It is baffling the cast they've got. Because obviously, I mean, two big name leads in Mark Wahlberg and Halle Berry. But then, yeah, like you mentioned, J.K. Simmons in it, Jackie L. Haley, Lorraine Bracco shows up for like just a couple of brief scenes.
The only explanation is that it was just a great paycheck and everyone wanted a holiday in London. That's all I can think.
And you get the impression with J.K. Simmons, for example, that he didn't necessarily have a huge number of days where he was shooting for.
Were any of these people in the same room together at any point? Who
it's
knows?
Definitely got that kind of plasticky sort of vibe to it. But, you know, passable as far as I'm concerned.
I was in like real, like a death rattle of cinema spiral with this. Like, I was just thinking, like, what are we doing making this? Think of all like the great upcoming filmmakers that you could have funded their first film with the cash that you spent on this. Just such a pointless endeavor for everyone involved. The thing that annoyed me the most really was just having Mark Wahlberg at the center of it, because he just doesn't make sense as this character. Like, the whole point is that he's just meant to be an everyman, like someone you pull off the street. But he's like just insanely jacked. So he's not an everyman, is he? Like, he's an action star. I mean, this is a problem throughout cinema history, of course. Like, this is nothing new. But I just thought, if you're going, these are like the blue collar guys who get stuff done that you don't recognize on the street. Like, why are you casting Mark Wahlberg in this role? Cast someone a bit more normal. And it would have been far more effective. But it's how movies get made, innit? You have to cast a name, otherwise it's not going to work. But yeah, I'll also say that this film has probably the most dire car chase I've ever seen in a film in it. It's so unexciting. It's just two cars like driving at a moderately fast speed sort of next to each other. Zero like interesting like blocking or action choreography going on with it. Just couldn't believe my eyes, like just how poor it was at points.
You also get an early moment of Wahlberg driving on the wrong side of the road as well.
Just terrible. So bad. If you want to have a terrible time, then go for it.
So if you fancy checking out, that is The Union, which is on Netflix now. So, I mean, you could really stream both The Union and Jackpot this weekend and then tell us which one you thought was appalling, which one you thought was kind of a decent enough time passer. But we're almost at the end of the week, Jordan. And I mean, it's time for Film of the Week, but do we really need to say, but what is your Film of the Week, Jordan?
I mean, basically by default, it's Alien Romulus, but I did really like Alien Romulus as well. So it's a worthy film of the week.
Same, exactly the same. And we're approaching the end of the podcast now, but just a quick reminder that our Beetlejuice issue has gone on sale now. So it's in shops right now. And that features a cracking cover feature by former host of this podcast, Jane Crowther, with loads of access to Tim Burton, Michael Keaton, Winona Ryder, General Ortega, more, and set access as well. So it's a real full bells and whistles preparation for Beetlejuice for you there. And if you take out a subscription, if you don't already have one, you can get instant digital access to that Beetlejuice issue. So you can start reading it right away before your first print copy arrives. So if you fancy joining us, there will be a subscription link in the podcast notes. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, please do subscribe and review on your podcast app of choice. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just one quick question, and this one is going to be in honor of Romulus. Jordan, if you could have an interquel to any couple of films, so like a sequel set between two existing films, what would you go for?
God, this was really tricky. I eventually settled on, even though an interquel does sort of technically exist, I settled on an interquel between Unbreakable and Glass. Of course, you could point to Split as an interquel, but just purely because I would have loved like another film with David Dunn where it wasn't his final outing, because you get the origin story in Unbreakable, and then we never really get to see David Dunn at like the peak of his powers, you know, like going out, keeping the city safe. Like, that's kind of what I'd want. I'd want like the Dark Knight of that trilogy, basically, because instead of that film, we got Split, which is a great film, but I was left wanting more David Dunn at the end of Glass, and an interquel could fit that bill nicely.
It's funny because I've just sort of talked myself out of mine, because I was going to go for an obvious one and say, just being such a massive fan of the Dark Knight trilogy, I would like an interquel between Batman Begins and the Dark Knight, just for a bit more Batman action. But then I thought, oh, well, we kind of had that with the Batman in a way. That's effectively what
it's true,
that is,
really.
So maybe that doesn't count. But yeah, I'd just take more time in the Dark Knight world any way I could get it. There you go. Let us know if there's an interquel you'd like to see. But that's it for this week. The podcast will return next week. And until then, goodbye.
Bye.
Iceman, you know I'm not playing. Devastate the show while the turtles.